Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Counters Paul George's 26 points. Here's George for three. He's got it. Paul George will step back. Jumper got it over Carroll. Paul George, and who knew if he was going to be able to come back and be this kind of player. Oh, DeRozan goes right by. All the way in. A little spin by Joseph. And there's the rookie, Norman Powell, with a steal and a dunk. Kicks it across to DeRozan for three. Yes! In the corner, Corey Joseph. Oh, another one falls. They're looking for George, and he's got George. The catch, dish, Solomon Hill. Oh, it goes. Did he get it off in time? This one would force overtime. Ruling on the floor is no basket. The decision has been made. No basket. Toronto wins it. An incredible comeback win. Outscoring the Pacers 25-9.
Me and this guy work extremely too hard to not have him come. It's all about patience. You know, you can't get flustered, you can't get frustrated, you got to stay the course. You know, that's what we're going to continue to do and do whatever it takes to win.
A group out there that was playing hard and playing together, we were on one string, and I think that group, we just played. Like, we just was like, all right, we ain't got no choice. We try to just grind it out and get stops and push.
We took the shot. They got about 1 second. You know, I was thinking, make the shot. Well, what's the point if you get it off and you don't make it? You know, it's a combination of both. I didn't really know the time. I just tried to shoot it. I think I was probably like 1/10 of a second off, and it didn't count.
It was just, you know, a good team win. All up and down the roster, guys playing well on both ends of the court. You know, now we just have to take this same type of mentality, the same type of effort, and take it on the road.
I think obviously it wasn't about the start tonight, but they had their 24-3 runs at one time or another. We can't let that happen. The only thing that I was told is that on that play in the fourth quarter, he twisted his ankle with a mild ankle sprain, from what they can tell. And so he'll get treatment, he'll get a film tomorrow, and go from there.
You're 1-2. You know, it. I just don't know when, and I know it didn't happen in the same game. I can tell you that for a fact. But it did happen, and so now we have to move to the next step for us. You know, in our eyes, it's a 2-2 series. We still have home court. No one's won a road game yet in this series. And so now we have to find a way of winning tomorrow. And that's as far as we can think right now.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Loaded up and ready to go are we right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. NBA action is fantastic. I think that's fair to say. That's an old NBA advertising gimmick or slogan or whatever. They haven't done the fantastic thing in years. I can't even remember the last time they did that.
But that sounds like a late 90s thing.
Yeah, I think so. I think you might be right, Jim Cushlin. NBA action is fantastic. Focus, of course, on all the fans. But really, really, it's been an unbelievably intriguing NBA playoff run thus far. And we're still just to the, you know, getting to the end of the first round series. Not even at the end of a lot of them.
Which is amazing to think about, because usually in the NBA, the first round is boring as hell.
Yeah, you're right. Most of the time. But this has been some really, really interesting stuff. Even the sweep wasn't very boring. I think the only one that was boring really was the Spurs domination of the Grizzlies.
The half Grizzlies, really.
Right. And that's one of the reasons it was boring, to be honest. But you know, the sweep by the Cavaliers over the Pistons was anything but boring. All four games were very, very close.
Yes.
Or were very competitive, even if the final scores. And even, what was the biggest margin of victory? Like 7 or something?
No, the 107-90 game 2 win.
Oh, that's right. They blew them out one game. That's right. Good
and that
point.
Was still
Good
a point. Close game for most of the first half. They turned on a different gear in the third quarter. But outside of the second half of game 2, that entire Cavs-Pistons series was close.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right. So So you look at the NBA playoffs this particular year, and you know they're really, really exciting even in the first round, and there's still obviously a long way to go. You look at the first round series, the Raptors now lead the Pacers after that unbelievable. That's one of the best games. I don't care. In fact, I kind of care that I didn't have any team to care about. I'm not. If I had my druthers, I guess I would like to see the Pacers win the series because it's, you know, Paul George is such a great story and coming back, and they're the underdog here anyway. And I just, you know, I don't really care. I don't have a rooting interest in it, which was my original point here. And when you watch a great game like that, when you don't have much of a rooting interest, you can really just enjoy it for the excitement of it. You know, rather than if you've got a team you're rooting for, if you see them collapsing in the fourth quarter and giving up a 13-point lead, you know, you're pulling your hair out. And if you have a team that is doing it, you're jumping up and down for joy as they continue to come back. If you don't have a rooting interest, you just appreciate it for the theater of the game, for the basketball of it all. And that's what I was like yesterday watching the Raptors and the Pacers. An unbelievable comeback. Kushlin just put it together there for you. A little bit of the montage there included the great comeback by. It was a 21-2 run by the Raptors.
25-9 total in the fourth quarter, and then the big run that you're talking about in the middle of all that.
There you go. That was a big part of that. And then despite all that, the Pacers have a chance to tie it and go to overtime. And what happens? A tenth of a second is exactly right. A tenth of a second short. From extending that into overtime with a game tying three. So a really remarkable game there. The Heat and the Hornets go again tonight. They are tied at two games apiece. Very interesting there. A Chris Bosh side story to that we would like to talk about a little bit later on too. Chris Bosh wants to play right now. He and his wife have taken social media to say, I'm ready to play. I don't have blood clots in my lungs. I'm good. I'm cleared. Let's go. The Heat remain non-committal. The Heat don't want to put him back in, apparently, just out of, you know, for precautionary measures.
Yeah, and this
we
one,
know
of course,
what's better for you than you do. Our doctors say, yeah, you could play, but what if something happened? It's a really strange dynamic down there. What was that, Jim?
Yeah, and the reason it's a strange dynamic, too, it's this year. Last year it was in the lungs. That's what shut him down, no questions asked, for the duration. This year it was in the legs. And that's why there's the chance that he could come back, because I'm not trying to knock it. It's a little less severe, obviously. It's still a pretty serious issue, but because it's the leg and not the lungs, that's why this possible door is even open. And quite frankly, they need him.
What's weird about it, you know, is the role reversal.
Yeah.
Because normally, I don't know that there's any normal with a situation like this, but in the past we have seen instances where the team wants the guy back, a player back. Come on, don't milk it. Don't nurse your injury. Doc has cleared you. Let's go. I'll give you a prime example. Example number one, Derrick Rose. Derrick Rose was cleared by the Chicago Bulls to play 2 years ago for a long time, and he kept saying he didn't trust it. It didn't feel right. He's able to go on it full speed in practice, jumping, cutting, darting, slashing, running, falling, everything else, but just to him, mentally, he didn't feel right, so he kept missing, right? Maybe it was three seasons ago now. And so that's more often the way it goes, where a team is like, hey, the doc has cleared you, let's go, but the player just doesn't rush back, kind of a thing. And in this case, the exact opposite going on. Chris Bosh is saying, I'm ready to go. Let me earn my $18 million. You're paying me this big money deal. We got a series we can win here. We might be able to win the East, for crying out loud. You let me come back. Play with Joe Johnson, Dwayne Wade, and the boys. And the Heat are the ones saying, yeah, we're not really sure if you're ready for that. Really strange story down there. We're going to talk about that. The rest of the East, of course, is the Hawks taking a 3-2 lead over the Celtics with their win last night. Really dominated them completely in that particular win. They've had two big wins over Boston, have the Hawks. They beat them in game 2, 89-72. They beat them last night, 110-83. The first one was a nail biter, 102-101 in Boston. Of course, won the two in Boston. So That series remains very exciting.
In addition to that, that's another one of the biggest stories to me, Bob, in this whole first round of the NBA playoffs is the little injuries that have obviously popped up. And I played the cut of Brad Stevens in there. That ankle he was talking about belongs to, I believe, one Isaiah Thomas.
Yeah, their own all-star point guard, if you will, the guy who kind of makes them go. And we'll get to the point guard injuries in the Western Conference here in just a second, by the way. So, in fact, let's just do that. Let's get to the Western Conference just to kind of give you a recap of where we are, because we're going to talk more about this in a bit. But the Warriors go again tonight, game number 5. They hope to close out the Rockets in 5, obviously.
The whole Curry story is what makes that one interesting.
And Steph Curry's injury has not been a factor thus far. Really for the Golden State Warriors. You know, they won without him. They won a game that was close when he got hurt and won the second half. They blew out the Rockets 121-94 in game number 4. In large part because the Rockets, I've said it before, not to sound repetitive, but it is what it is. They're a train wreck. They are a hot mess. They are just not a cohesive unit. This should be about as easy of a win that a Curry-less Warriors team will get, I think, the rest of the way. And they're going to be without Curry for, according to most reports out of Oakland, the first 4 games of the second round, minimum. That's minimum. So this will probably be the easiest game they'll play without him against this Warriors team, or this Rockets team that, quite frankly, is probably already beaten. The Spurs, as we know, beat Memphis in a 4-game sweep. The only real boring one, they await the winner. The Thunder, of course, closed out the Mavericks in that epic game with Kevin Durant and Russell Westbrook, each going over 30, and then Kevin Durant calling Mark Cuban an idiot for daring to suggest that Westbrook is not a superstar as well.
And the game 1 of that series is slated for Saturday. They're looking at afternoon, but they haven't officially posted a time. I say that because if it is that afternoon slot, we'll have that for you here on the ticket.
That is good to know. That is very good to know. And then, of course, the other series out west, the one as we talk about injuries, and it just, you know, it's really interesting. They were talking about curses on ESPN this morning. If you listen to the ESPN morning show, Mike and Mike in the Morning right here, on 106.5 The Ticket, then you're doing it right. But they were talking this morning about curses. And Greeny is a big believer. Golic is not. I have never been. Because I hear people talking about the curse in Cleveland. That is, you know, maybe because of Chief Wahoo or because of the trade of Rocky Colavito or whatever it is causing all of the, you know, the bad luck to be there in Cleveland, Ohio. Well, out there in L.A., in Clipperland, there's supposedly a curse that hangs over the Clippers franchise. And there's no other explanation, says Greeny, for Chris Paul breaking his hand and missing the rest of the postseason, probably, because they're probably not going to get past the Blazers. And Blake Griffin doing the same thing, injuring that quad again, and he is done for the remainder of the season. That this team could have been, as a 4 seed in the West, could have been as big of a threat to the Warriors for the Western Conference title as anybody. And I agreed with that. I was looking forward to a Clippers-Warriors second-round matchup that was going to be epic between Chris Paul and Steph Curry. And when Steph Curry was out, I thought, wow, Chris Paul gets to feast. And then Chris Paul gets knocked out, making you really wonder. A, are the Golden State Warriors charmed, living the charmed basketball god's existence? And B, are the Clippers indeed cursed, living a cursed existence where they can't catch a break? And I feel badly for them. I think they're probably not going to get by the Portland Trail Blazers in the series. You heard Doc Rivers there at the end, part of the montage that Kush put together. Doc saying, look, it's 2-2. Nobody has won a road game yet in this series. And, of course, game number 5 tonight is in Los Angeles. But what he neglected to say is nobody's had to play without their top 2 players and their top 2 scorers at any point in this series either.
And that's, of course, now for the duration, because Chris Paul had his surgery, I believe, this morning. That puts him officially out. They label it indefinitely because they
They're saying there is the slightest of chances that if they were to make the finals, he could be back.
Good luck with that one, Clip Show.
Well, but that's why. But that's why they use the word indefinitely right. for him and out for Griffin. Griffin is just done. The rest of the season, no matter what, they go to the finals or not done.
Yeah, and I'll go ahead and say, and you kind of alluded it to, but I feel even more certain saying this: the Blazers are going to win this in six, and then probably even without Curry, gets swept in round two by the Warriors. Because as I mentioned yesterday, we were talking about this, Bob. The Blazers, you know, good for them for picking up the pieces. They shouldn't have even been here with all they lost last offseason, but they're not ready for that kind of moment against the Warriors.
Yeah, they replaced four starters, for crying out loud. They replaced four starters. A remarkable job.
I assume they'd lose 50 games because of that.
What's that?
I assume they'd lose 50 games this year because of that.
Yeah, and instead here they are. So I agree with you. They've done a remarkable job. And FYI, in case you're wondering, the Blazers and the Warriors season series, Blazers 137, Warriors 105 back in February 19th, Warriors 128, Blazers 112 in March, and Warriors 136 to 111 in April. Those are all, of course, with Steph Curry. But guess what? With or without him, I'm with you. I don't think they'll sweep him. I do not think they'll sweep him without Steph Curry. I disagree with you on that point. I think Damian Lillard and the guys who have really come back hard, hard again in the series against the Clippers, will have enough juice to get at least a game from them in the next round, particularly without Curry. It's going to take some adjustment for the Warriors, and you know I don't think they're going to make all of the adjustments they need to make on how to run and how to rotate and how to drive the offense without Steph Curry, with Sean Livingston at the point position in tonight's game five against the Warriors or against the Rockets. I think it's going to take them a few games, and it could be one of those two or three games in the early going that. That Portland jumps on them and gets one from them. So that's just kind of an update on where we are. Really a remarkable game last night by the Raptors to come back and beat the Pacers. Not something I wanted to see. Of course, there's a lot of things in this NBA postseason that I didn't want to see. Injuries to a number of guys and results that I was not really a huge fan of either. But this is where we are. I think it's going to be a great second round between the Spurs and the Thunder. That one we know we have, and I'm really, really interested to see what happens with the Cavaliers. Is it going to be the Hawks, the return match between Delly and Korver, and who else hurt himself trying to mess with Delly last year? Horford, I think it was. Are we going to have
Jabari Carroll was one of the ones that got hurt. He's now with the Raptors. I don't think his play was involved with Delly, though.
Didn't Horford
was a little banged up, but he played through it, where Korver was done after that game, too.
Right. He was knocked out for the rest of the playoffs, obviously, if they had advanced. He was done. Korver was. But, no, the what was the Horford versus Dellavedova part of this? And I'm just trying to remember if there was allegations again of a cheap shot. Oh, you know what it was? It wasn't Horford being hurt by Dellavedova. It was Horford taking cheap shots at Dellavedova, presumably according to the Hawks fans.
That's right.
What happened with Korver?
Right. That was the Korver one was what was accused as dirty. Horford's the one who made the comments. Now you're making me remember the elbow.
No, right. I mean he got a flagrant for throwing an elbow, if memory serves.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, he dragged him to the floor at another one and really tried to rough Dellavedova up. And he got a flagrant two foul, was ejected out of one of the first, I don't know if it was game two or game three or whatever it was, but Al Horford was ejected. So anyway, my point to all of that is could be some intrigue in round two if it's a rematch of the Cavs and the Hawks only because of Delly. The difference, of course, here, Delly probably wouldn't see nearly as much time because Kyrie Irving is playing tremendous basketball going into the second round, played better than really anybody else on the Cavaliers in the first round against the Pistons. So Delly's minutes aren't going to be probably as high as they were before.
Right, and that's when fracturing that kneecap in the finals, when Kyrie was really at his most banged up. If I'm not mistaken, he straight up missed two of those four games, and that's another reason Delly got so many minutes in that series.
Exactly. And so it'll be interesting, but not, don't expect them to actually circle up and get into an octagon against Dellavedova, because Delly won't have that many opportunities. All right, so we're going to talk a lot of NBA. Coming up at about 3:35, we're going to talk a little Major League Baseball as well. We had our big in-depth Tigers report yesterday from Anthony Fenech. Today we're going to get an in-depth Indians report from Zach Meisel. And for now, we're going to go to the phones at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065, to talk about these NBA playoffs. Brian in Toledo's sitting ever so patiently waiting for us to stop talking so that he may start. Hey, Brian, go ahead and start.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Of course. What's up?
Hey, just wanted to, I catch the show every day after I leave work, you know, and I'm a big fan of you guys, and I wanted to go back to a conversation you guys had yesterday about the Coach of the Year in the NBA.
Yeah, the Steve Kerr thing.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on, I don't agree that Steve Kerr should have won it, missing that many games at the beginning of the season. I get the whole 75, or, you know, how many ever wins the Warriors had, but
yeah, 73.
I read an article on ESPN, and I can't remember if you guys had thrown this out there after I shut the car off and stopped listening, but the job that Dave Yeager did in Memphis, I thought he should have had some consideration in there as well. I think they said that he used 26 players this season, and the highest before that for any team to make the playoffs was 23. In 1 year. So I just, you know, was throwing that out there thinking, you know, he should have had some consideration in there as well.
I think you're 100% right. And he did get, and I don't know exactly, I don't have the voting in front of me, Jim, so if you have it, to let me know exactly what the totals look like for the Coach of the Year balloting. But you could not be more right. You know, it's weird. When you talk about the Coach of the Year in the NBA, it is always, is it supposed to be the coach whose team had the best record, particularly if they set a record like Steve Kerr did, with his missing a lot of games notwithstanding, with the Warriors, or Greg Popovich, who just continues to be one of the masters of any sport in terms of his head coaching acumen, his five championships, his constant division title after division title. He weaves just almost, you know, an amazing tapestry with his youth, blending it in with his older guys, knowing exactly how long he needs to rest Duncan, when he needs to sit Parker, Ginobili, and the rest of the, you know, the graybeards, while weaving them in there with the young Patty Mills and Kawhi Leonard and Danny Green, and we know the routine, and then along with the free agent LaMarcus Aldridge, he just takes these guys and just blends them perfectly and is there every time. Do we give a Coach of the Year to the, you know, the coach whose team did the best, or does it always have to be somebody who was not expected to achieve much, but overachieved? And that's where we get the Brad Stevens from Boston. And yes, Dave Yeager absolutely belongs in this conversation for what he did with the Grizzlies, having to use so many players because of so many injuries and so many other obstacles in the path to put together a playoff team and a season the way that he did. He absolutely deserves some mention. Should he have won it? Probably not, but it's just a question of, you know, who did a better job with what they had than Dave Yeager? Maybe you look at Stevens, right. Maybe you look at Stotts in Portland. I know, Jim, you said that was your pick yesterday, right?
Yeah, that was my pick, and I have the results. It was Steve Kerr. I'm going to read these by first-place votes. Steve Kerr had 64, Terry Stotts 37, Pop had 10, Steve Clifford in Charlotte got 7, Dwayne Casey of the Raptors 6, then you have Brad Stevens 5, and Yeager had 1 first-place vote.
You only had 1?
He only had 1 first-place vote, 11 total.
Yeah, and I'm a little surprised by that, but your point, Brian, I think is a very, very good one. But the larger question is how should the media vote for this? Should it be, you know, the guy that did the most with the least? Is that what the Coach of the Year is? Or is it the guy who did what he was supposed to do with what he had? I mean, you know, Steve Kerr is a unique situation because he missed, you know, more than half the games, and Luke Walton did such a great job. But
Luke Walton got 5 total votes, by the way, even though he never was officially the head coach. As far as the record books are concerned, all 73-9 do go to Kerr.
Right.
But Walton should get credit. Some voters did give him credit for that. They gave him 5 votes at the bottom.
But, you know, Popovich, what did the Spurs win? 67?
67.
67 games. You know, Popovich is almost kind of becoming like LeBron in that he's always a candidate any year, and he could be the Coach of the Year any year because they're always so good, but we're used to him winning and we're used to seeing him succeed, so we kind of overlook how great he is. And that's kind of the way it is for LeBron, I think, and sometimes in the MVP voting. And so, you know, is it right to look at Yeager and Stotts and these guys and say, hey, they did more with less? But that's not Greg Popovich's fault. All he did was win 67 games, one of the great all-time seasons, single-season win totals in history, with a team that he, you know, with a better roster.
Well, here's my next question. If and do you guys think that that Kerr wins it if they fall a game or two short of breaking that record?
Probably.
You know what I mean? If they don't break the record, maybe it's Popovich that wins it, you know, like you're saying. So, you know,
I don't think so. I still think because of the run, you know, because if they won 70 games, only the second team ever to win 70 games, you know, what if they had finished with 71, one shy of the Bulls? It still would have been seen as remarkable accomplishment, one of the greatest seasons ever. And quite honestly, as you know, you probably know, Steve Kerr is very, very well liked. By the media, by the rest of the coaching community, he's liked by everybody, and his story is a really crazy one in that he was enduring some, like, inexplicable pain during that time that he was out, things that we can't understand. I mean, it was supposedly just crippling pain that Steve Kerr was in and continues to battle. So there might be a little bit of a, not only did his team win 70-plus games, but also, wow, what a heroic effort for this guy to keep pushing and battling through that pain in order to be there for his team at all. So it might be one of those "what an awesome guy" awards too. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah, I think Pop will always be overlooked. To be honest with you, I think he'll always be overlooked. He wins very, you know, it's like Phil Jackson very rarely won Coach of the Year too. Why? Because he had Michael and Scottie. You don't have to coach them. You know, and then you had Kobe and Shaq. You don't have to coach them. Phil Jackson won very few because it was just believed that, hey, you know, you should win that many with the talent you have. And I think that's a little unfortunate when it comes to guys like Popovich.
Gotcha. Thanks for taking the call, guys. Appreciate it.
You got it. I appreciate the discussion. Yeah.
And that's a fascinating topic, you know, to me about this coach voting. I even heard some throw out a possible argument. I'm not saying this is correct, but I'm throwing it onto the pile, if you will, that part of Steve Kerr getting it, in addition to the Warriors setting the record despite him not physically being there because of his issues for half the season, was he didn't get it last year because Mike Budenholzer of the Hawks got it last year. And there are some who are saying, well, maybe a couple of votes here and there. Maybe, oh, I should have given it to him last year. Now they win 73, so I'm definitely doing it now.
I even heard that thrown out. That very well could be. But to me, here's, you know, this is just one of these things. And I'll say, and then we got to get out so we can get ready for Zach Meisel and talk a little baseball. Steve Kerr had 381 points, 50 plus, or roughly 50, a little less than 50 ahead of Terry Stotts, who finished second with 335 total points. Greg Popovich had 166. He was third. Terry Stotts had to replace four starters, as you pointed out, and did so and took the Blazers to the playoffs. Greg Popovich didn't have to replace four starters. In fact, took one of the starters from Portland, LaMarcus Aldridge, and weaved him into his little group and his rotation in San Antonio and won 67 games. If you're doing the fairness factor, saying that, well, Stotts had a lot less to work with, so therefore he did a better coaching job, you say, is it Greg Popovich's fault that he didn't have to replace four starters? Is it Greg Popovich's fault? Should his job of coaching the Spurs be recognized as any less terrific, any less impressive than Terry Stotts simply because he had the benefit of having better players? It's not like Popovich had better players and Stotts had weaker players and the Spurs finished with just a few more wins. Popovich had better players and won 67 games, one of the great single-season records of all time. Remember, after the Bulls in their 72, the record was 69. So they were two away from the greatest record of all time.
Believe it or not, I don't think any single team has won 68 in a season. And then there's a various bunch, this year's Spurs and last year's Warriors being the most recent that have won 67.
That's my point, which makes it a historic achievement.
You know, it's, with a bunch it's, of it's, others
it's like,
for
it's
fourth
like one
best
of the top
all time.
Five or six single season records in NBA history. How does that guy not win the Coach of the Year? And how does he not only not win the Coach of the Year, how does he finish so far behind Terry Stotts of the Blazers this year? I mean, think about it. I get it. I understand Stotts had less to work with, but it's not like Popovich had a lot more to work with than just won a few more games. He won a ton more games than almost anybody else in NBA history, and that ought to be recognized too. All right, let me get out because we got to get to baseball talk. Zach Meisel in the wings right here. And we'll get
the ticket.
Indeed, as we roll on, it's 3:41. Thanks for joining us right here on Toledo Sports Leader. Phone lines will be open again shortly at 866-240-1065. Don't forget, we're trying to blend our social media with our on-air product more than we've ever had before, so make sure you follow us and leave comments if you choose on our Twitter feed, which is Sports Radio 106.5, or our Facebook page, which is 106.5 The Ticket. Now, I want to make a sharp turn here away from the NBA playoffs for a moment, get back to baseball. Yesterday, we had our weekly Tigers update from Anthony Fenech of the Detroit Free Press. And joining us now to talk a little bit about baseball to the east of us out in Cleveland is an outstanding baseball writer, quite frankly, just an outstanding sports writer, Zach Meisel with the Northeast Ohio Media Group and the Cleveland.com and Cleveland Plain Dealer as well. Zach, what's going on, buddy?
Not much. Did you ask Mr. Fenech what it was like to fall asleep in the middle of a game the other day?
Why? Did he doze off?
No, he's got a penchant for falling asleep at the most just inopportune times. And he was doing the thing in the press box where, like, if you're on an airplane, yeah, you start nodding off and yeah, you catch yourself and you're like, and he was doing that. I don't remember if the game had started or not, but I've got some good video. Maybe I can post it to 106.5 The Ticket's Facebook page.
You've got to, or at least send it to me or something, and I'll post it so you don't get in trouble with the guy. Do you know Anthony well, or you just see him from time to time in the press boxes?
Yeah, we go back a few years, and we've become pretty friendly.
That's awesome.
And it's always fun when we make the trip to Detroit or they come here.
Does he have narcolepsy, or is he just, you know, like pulling all-nighters and, you know, and he's feeling it the next day?
You know, some maybe a little of both. Supposedly it's happened. This isn't the first time it's happened, and it's not just at baseball stadiums. It's just, I don't know. I guess anytime you can catch up on your sleep and you got a couple minutes, it's worthwhile.
Oh, that is class. I had no idea. And, you know, we bust his chops about – we bust each other's chops, obviously. We have a good time. He's a great guy and a great writer, and we enjoy talking to him. But I did not know. Thank you. This is new ammunition. Do me a favor.
Sure.
Don't post it. Send it to me so that I can post it the day next day we have him on next week so that we can kind of catch him off guard. Does he know? Do you guys, like, ever, you know, kind of josh him a little bit about it? Do people say josh each other anymore?
I
just date myself by, like, way too many?
Well, when he opened his eyes the other day, he saw a few people staring at him. So,
but did he see you videotaping him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had to show him, and we'll see. I think maybe now he'll think twice before he nods off.
Oh, that is awesome. That is classic. We're going to have some fun with that. I appreciate you letting me know that. All right, Zach, let's talk about what started out to be, you know, the Indians' strength going into the season, obviously, the starting pitching rotation, and all kinds of changes are afoot now. Obviously, Carlos Carrasco being down on the DL for at least 15 days, you know, creates a hole in the rotation that's probably going to be filled by Trevor Bauer. I guess you can tell us about that. You know, and now Cody Anderson is struggling a bit. You know, he's given up 5 runs, I think, in 3 different starts. And maybe there's some talk about should he get another start or they need to pull the trigger there again. Give us the overall lowdown on where the starters are right now.
Yeah, there really hasn't been anybody who's been consistently good except Carrasco, and he's the guy who now is probably going to miss a month or two. Josh Tomlin's pitched really well in his 2 starts, but it's only been 2 starts for him.
Right.
There are some definite questions, and all of a sudden this rotation is not as rock solid as we thought. And there are enough questions with the offense and the bullpen where this is a growing concern. The Indians didn't really think that they would have to worry about the rotation. And Trevor Bauer will be replacing Carrasco among the starting 5. He'll start this weekend in Philadelphia. I don't think the Indians are so much worried with that. He should be able to throw the normal amount of pitches he can throw. He's basically had the attitude of whenever they tell me I'm going to pitch, I'll pitch, and that's that, whether he's in the bullpen or the rotation. But the guy that is worrisome is Cody Anderson, and it's more worrisome now because Carrasco went down. Remember when Lonnie Chisenhall and Michael Brantley were coming back, the thought was, okay, well, Anderson's had a couple of rough starts. Maybe you send him down, move Bauer to the rotation, and you've got your 5. But with Carrasco injured, now you have your 5, and there really isn't much room for error. So there is a question about what they do next with Cody Anderson. They have some flexibility here. They won't need a 5th starter for 10 days. So if they really wanted to and they made the move today, they could send him to AAA for a start. And then if all goes well, they could call him back up in 10 days. There's a 10-day rule. But they found something in his delivery that they'd like to tweak late last night. It's just a question of would they rather he do that in 10 days at the big league level or get a AAA start in there in between.
We're talking to Zach Meisel, a little Major League Baseball talk today. The Indians struggling to close out the Twins a couple of times in a row. Now we're talking about the starting pitching. If they did decide, now the hole you just pointed out certainly is beneficial to them that they don't need a fifth starter for about a week and a half, and that's good. But if it goes beyond that, and they want to replace him when they do need a fifth starter, what do they do without Bauer there? Would they go and upset the bullpen and put McAllister back in the rotation? Or because, you know, that was, of course, a consideration in the spring, or would they reach down to Columbus? What would be the best alternative if they had to do so?
Well, I think they'd have to reach down to Columbus. The question there is who would be the guy? Because Michael Clevinger is probably their top starting pitching prospect who's close to ready, but I don't think he's ready. He's made four starts at AAA this year. He pitched for AAA at the very end of last year in the postseason, but that's about it. So I think they would like to give him some more seasoning. And TJ House would be the other guy, but he hasn't looked very good in three starts at AAA. So I wonder if they'll just maybe pull the trigger on this just to buy them some time. And they would love – so the other part of the equation is because the starting pitching has been kind of sloppy for the last week, the bullpen has finally been used and overused, and we've seen Cody Allen and Brian Shaw have their struggles. We've seen McAllister pitch quite a bit. We've seen Chamberlain and Ross Detweiler getting more games, Jeff Manship. So I know Terry Francona would love another reliever. So you could send Anderson down for 10 days. You could bring back Tommy Hunter, who is, by all accounts, ready for activation from the disabled list down there at AAA. And that would help. And the reason why I don't think they would pull the trigger on McAllister is, number one, I don't think he's built up to go more than a few innings at this point. And the second part is, the way Allen and Shaw are struggling, I think you kind of need McAllister, who he gave up the home run in the ninth inning on Monday, but that's the first run he's given up all year. And he's kind of been the steady force, him and Jeff Manship, in the back of the bullpen. And if Sean Allen are going to continue to struggle, I think they're going to rely a lot on McAllister, Manship, and maybe eventually Tommy Hunter.
What is wrong with Cody Allen and Brian Shaw?
It's a good question, and it's easy to point the fingers to say, well, the two have more appearances than any other pitcher in baseball over the last 3 years. It's really easy to say that. I don't know that that's necessarily actually correct in why they have struggled. Shaw one day in Detroit looks like he can't find the strike zone. He's getting pounded around. He's walking guys, can't locate anything. And then he comes back a day later in Minnesota and just blows people away, throwing 94, 95 with tons of movement, throwing strikes, and it looks like a piece of cake. So I think with him, it's more just location, and he's got to be more consistent with throwing strikes. With Allen, it's a little strange because he's not throwing as hard in April as he has in Aprils of past years. And I think he seems fine. He's not concerned. I don't think the Indians are concerned. He got off to a miserable start last year too, but it is a little strange because he's getting hit hard. Last night he faced four batters, all four batters reached. And he's walking people. He's giving up hits and he's giving up home runs, which he usually doesn't do. So Allen is a bit of a question mark, but again, he is 6-for-6 in saves, and he hasn't given up a run in the save situation. So I think they're kind of confident with him. But Brian Shaw is kind of the question mark because his stuff is there. It's just a matter of location and consistency.
We're talking baseball with Zach Meisel, Cleveland.com, the Northeast Ohio Media Group, covering the Cleveland Indians, talking about the American League Central. And let's go beyond that, too, if we can. That sweep in Detroit, well, this is within the Central, so I take that back. We're not going beyond it yet. But that sweep in Detroit, which, of course, hadn't been done for, what was it? How many years had it been since they had a sweep in Detroit? It was like 12 years or something?
Almost, yeah, August of 2008. Almost 8 years.
Okay, 8 years. There you go. Thank you. I couldn't remember the number. But at any rate, there's no such thing as an April statement, but I think that had to be a real, real pick-me-up for Terry Francona and his guys because, you know, the Tigers, they were in the middle of their own slump anyway, or maybe the Indians kind of created and officially made it a slump, but they had a closed-door meeting. They had their own problems. But that's a good team. That's a loaded lineup that isn't performing at its peak capacity right now. You know, our Tigers listeners are certainly well aware of that. They're so frustrated. Brad Ausmus is out there accusing Brian Shaw of scuffing up the ball with his his ring, and Collins, the outfielder, flipping off the fans who were booing him the other day. That's a good team, though. How much do you think that meant to the Indians? Again, without overstating it, since it's mid to late April, to go up there against a division rival that they've had, some go rounds with, and take three in a row.
Yeah, I think it meant a lot more to the Indians than it did to the Tigers. I think, of course, if you follow that up by getting swept at Minnesota, who was 5-14 a couple of days ago, I think it loses a little bit of its luster. But even Trevor Bauer said, hey, we now know we can come in here, and it's not just going to be like it has been for the past few years. We actually stand a chance. And if you, going into the series, you looked at it, you had Josh Tomlin against Justin Verlander on Friday night. It seemed like that's in Detroit's favor. Miguel Cabrera had been struggling mightily at the plate. He hit 600 against the Indians last year, so he kind of figured this would be the chance that he bust out of that. But the Indians, they won on Friday in a really well-pitched game. They won on Saturday when their offense went crazy and Corey Kluber finally had a really good start. And then they won on Sunday when, in a game where Brian Shaw loads the bases in the eighth inning, the lead gets cut to two, Miguel Cabrera comes up. That's a game the Indians would have lost in years past, and they hung on and won with a great job from Jeff Manship and Cody Allen. So they won in very different kinds of ways. They really held Detroit's offense in check, and trust me, they knew going into it that they have been absolutely terrible against the Tigers for the last few years, and especially so at Comerica Park. So I think it meant something, and it really meant something because they've struggled in April the last few years. They've been asked about it constantly. And there isn't really an easy answer to why they've struggled to the degree in which they have. And to go out and, first of all, they came into Detroit having lost 3 of 4. And all of a sudden you could start to see maybe things would snowball. It would be another miserable April where they'd be a few games under 500. And instead they go into Detroit and they do something they haven't done in 8 years. And I think, even if they do finish this road trip and they're like 5-4 or something like that, that's not overwhelmingly good. At least they can go back to Detroit in a couple of months and not feel like they're already at a disadvantage.
Yeah, I think that's well said, and you're right. It certainly means a lot more to the Indians than Detroit, but it certainly also is taken away if you go out there and get swept by Minnesota. So we'll see what happens tonight. Sitting at 9-9, 500 right now. Not a horrible place to be, but 4.5 behind the red hot, by the way, 5 straight for the Chicago White Sox. Leaving the division, just a couple of other baseball stories to talk about with you. Jake Arrieta is shocking a lot of people. Two no-hitters, obviously, in his last 11 starts, and people are just, like, amazed at what this former journeyman has become. And he did an interview. This is one of those things where it's weird, Zach, which is why I'm asking you about it. He did an interview in which he brought up the letters PED. Not a writer, not a columnist, not a talk show host being just trying to be controversial for the sake of it. But he said in an interview that he is asked, or he has heard people whispering about, has he done steroids? Is that what he did to take himself from being kind of a nobody to one of the most dominant pitchers in baseball right now? Are we still in the age in 2016 where somebody doing something really, really special automatically raises the antenna for us that says, is it legal? Is it natural? Or is there something something fishy going on here? And are you shocked that he would be the one to bring it up? Not a writer, not a columnist, not somebody in the media.
Yeah, I mean, we still see people getting busted, it seems like, every week in any league, whether it's the NFL, MLB. And so I do think there's a little bit of skepticism still out there when someone is anything special, especially with his background. But it's tough because I wonder, when a pitcher brings something up like that, what was he reading? What do players read that they feel like they have to defend themselves? Because the thought had never crossed my mind that would be the reason to explain his success over the last couple of years.
Mine either. And I'll be honest with you, Zach, I don't know if he read it, because that would obviously indicate that somebody wrote it, or if he just heard whispers. I don't know exactly what he said he heard, or where, why he got this into his head, or he felt the need to respond to it and get out in front of it, I guess. So I don't know if it was read or heard, but I hadn't even thought of it either. And I was kind of thinking that's a good thing, that maybe we're getting past a lot of that. But as you point out, we are still seeing it in a lot of other places.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really connect Bryce Harper or Mike Trout to that at all. So it is a little strange that he would bring that up. It's weird. I mean, I think he's doing something so special. He's really had the best maybe calendar year of pitching in at least 15 years. And so, I it's tough. I don't know why he would be so defensive about that, why he would bring that up. But you have to figure he read or heard something somewhere, and this was his chance to squash it. But you're right. I mean, we've heard that this guy works out tirelessly. He is built like an ox. He's very athletic, and it shows in his pitching. But the thing is, he's always had talent, and he was always a guy who was looked at, who had the ability, maybe not to do what he's doing to this degree, but to be a successful pitcher. He was really good in the minor leagues, and he came up, and the Orioles had a lot of high thoughts of him, and it just never translated, never clicked until he got to Chicago, and he said his pitching coaches had a lot to do with that. So it's strange, and it's I guess that's still an easy finger for some people to point. But I think for the most part we've gotten past that, but again, people are still getting busted, so you never really know.
Yeah, just to clarify that dominance you were talking about, in his last 24 starts dating back to last regular season, he's 20-1 with a 0.86. He came to the Cubs in 2013 from the Orioles with a career ERA over 5. So there certainly is, I guess, if anybody is questioning it, because you're looking for a reason. You're looking, how does somebody become that much better with just his own same routine? I'm assuming his workout routine is rigorous and as harsh as it is, as you're talking about, it hasn't changed, or maybe it has. I don't know. Everybody's looking for, how did that happen? From 5 to 0.86 in that span. And by the way, I'm looking at the story now. He doesn't say he read it. He just said it's flattering that some in the game are questioning whether or not he's used some sort of drug. So maybe it's just whispers, or maybe it's just that he knows that people probably are wondering, even if they're not saying it out loud, because of the sudden transformation. But, you know, we're all looking just as reasonable people for, how did that happen? You know, it'd be like a 5-point-a-game score in the NBA suddenly scoring 25 points a game. All right, what do you do different? What are you doing differently that made you such a better shooter than you've ever been before? What's he doing differently that makes him such a better pitcher than he's ever been before?
Yeah, well, with pitching, though, it's tough. Because yes, PEDs can help any player because you're going to recover faster, and in a 162-game schedule, that's mighty helpful.
Sure.
But with him, like, I look at his numbers, and when he was with Baltimore, and even his first year with Chicago, his walk rate was unbelievably high. He was walking like 4, 5, 6 batters per 9 innings. And he got that down to under 2 now the last 2 years. And it's not because he's stronger and he's recovering faster. That's just command and delivery
exactly.
And locating.
PEDs cannot improve that. That's exactly right. That's why this is a very strange thing, other than the strength. And as he points out, Zach, his body size isn't any different. He said, you know, again, in response, or not even response, because nobody even accused him yet, but getting out in front of it, he said, I've always been in good shape, but my body has always been very similar to how it is now. The results are different, so people want to question things. That's the nature of sports. But again, it's just trippy that I haven't heard anybody question it. I'm hearing him answer a question that really nobody, at least publicly, has asked.
Yeah, I guess if I was an opposing hitter, and I wanted to explain something away to the fans or to my coaches for why I just went 0-for-4 with 4 strikeouts, that might be an easy target.
There you go. that's very well said. Zach Meisel always has great things to say and great things to write as well. You can read him online at cleveland.com, a member of the Northeast Ohio Media Group and a writer for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Zach, thanks so much for the insight and the update on the Indian situation. It'll be interesting to see how Bauer steps into the rotation now after not making the rotation out of spring, now that he's got to be there for Carlos Carrasco. Hopefully he's got his head on straight and can give the Indians some quality starts. And maybe after a few of those, we'll get back and chat again. Sound good?
Always a pleasure. You
Thank
bet.
You, sir. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Oh, by the way, I'm looking forward to that Fennec video.
I can't wait.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Zach Meisel, Northeast Ohio Media Group with an Indians update. Yesterday we had Anthony Fennec, our Tigers writer, on. Not ours. He's the Detroit Free Press's Tigers writer, but he's a guy we have a frequent guest on this program. I think we're about to have a little bit of fun with Mr. Fennec, thanks to Mr. Meisel. SportsCenter, top of the hour, coming up now, and your phone calls after that, right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Paul George is 26 points. Here's George for three. He's got it. Paul George will step back. Jumper got it over Carroll. Paul George, and who knew if he was going to be able to come back and be this kind of player. Oh, DeRozan goes right by. All the way in. A little spin by Joseph. And there's the rookie, Norman Powell, with a steal and a dunk. Kicks it across to DeRozan for three. Yes! In the corner, Corey Joseph. Oh, another one falls. Still looking for George. And he's got George. The catch, dish, Solomon Hill. Oh, it goes. Did he get it off in time? This one would force overtime.
Me and this guy work extremely too hard to not have him come. It's all about patience. You know, you can't get flustered. You can't get frustrated. You got to stay the course. You know, that's what we're going to continue to do and do whatever it takes to win.
A group out there that was playing hard and playing together, we were on one string. And I think that group, we just played. Like, we just was like, all right, we ain't got no choice. We try to just grind it out and get stops and push.
We took the shot. There got about 1 second. You know, I was thinking, make the shot. Well, what's the point if you get it off and you don't make it? You know, it's a combination of both. I didn't really know the time. I just tried to shoot it. I think I was probably like 1/10 of a second off, and it didn't count.
It was just, you know, a good team win. All up and down the roster, guys playing well on both ends of the court. You know, now we just have to take the same type of mentality, the same type of effort, and take it on the road.
I think obviously it wasn't about the start tonight, but they had their 24-3 runs at one time or another. We can't let that happen. The only thing that I was told is that on that play in the fourth quarter, he twisted his ankle with a mild ankle sprain, from what they can tell. And so he'll get treatment, he'll get a film tomorrow, and go from there.
Yeah, when you lose, you're 1-2. You know, it I'm sure it's happened. I just don't know when, and I know it didn't happen in the same game. I can tell you that for a fact. But it did happen, and so now we have to move to the next step for us. You know, in our eyes, it's a 2-2 series. We still have home court. No one's won a road game yet in this series. And so now we have to find a way of winning tomorrow. And that's as far as we can think right now.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward we roll into hour number two. I got bad news for Doc Rivers that you heard at the end of all of that montage of sound and fury and highlights and comments. You're not going to win game number five, and you're probably not going to win game number six. It's probably going to be Portland in six, and the questions of the curse of the Clippers are going to continue to grow and expand. Welcome back as we continue. Hour number two is underway. Chris Paul, Blake Griffin gone. That is about as cursy as it gets. If you can use the word curse as an adjective, I guess I just did. It's about as cursy as it gets for the Clippers. Want to talk about the NBA and about the playoffs? A whole bunch of game fives tonight. And a couple of series already decided, obviously. So we'll get into, in fact, three of them already decided. Thunder took care of the Mavericks. Obviously, sweeps for the Cavaliers over the Pistons and the Spurs over the Memphis Grizzlies. Everything else is still in play, though. So if you want to talk about that, we can do that. We just heard from Zach Meisel talking baseball with us, MLB style. Duh, as opposed to some other style.
Well, it could have been Cushman style, like, you know, freshman.
Look at Ben Lahowski taking the shots at Cush. Well done, sir.
Yeah.
Ben is back behind the board pushing all the right buttons and answering your phone calls and everything else today, because Cushland had to leave early once again, so they didn't go out there and pretend that he knows something about the game of baseball. Did they at least make him take a test of some sort before they let him call balls and strikes?
I'm not sure, but I know yesterday they actually went to like extra innings or something after two were mercy rule games. He said, I knew it would come back to bite me eventually.
So he had to put in a little extra work.
Right.
All right, that's good to know. But anyway, Cushland is doing some freshman baseball umpiring today, so Big Ben is behind the board for us. And so when you dial, that'll be the voice that you hear will be Ben's. And that's at 866-240-1065. But we were talking to Zach about some baseball and Indian style and beyond. I'm curious to talk to you about this, too, and expand upon this a little bit. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on it. On the phones at 866-240-1065, Vince mentioned, or by way of Twitter or Facebook, you can leave comments for us at SportsRadio1065 on Twitter. Just tweet right at us, at SportsRadio1065. And on Facebook, at 1065, The Ticket. That is our Facebook handle. Jake Arrieta, the reigning National League Cy Young Award winner, said in an interview with ESPN, apparently, that it's flattering that some in the game are questioning whether he has used PEDs to achieve his status among the elite pitchers. And if you think about the elite pitchers right now, what names come to your mind? Maybe the first one is probably still Clayton Kershaw. Probably former Tiger David Price. Probably Giant October hero Madison Bumgarner. Probably, I'm trying to think who else deserves to be in this crowd. Probably not Max Scherzer the way he's pitching right now, but he was up there, particularly with the amount of money that they gave him. But at any rate, you know who they are, and Jake Arrieta's name is right up there with all of them. And he says it's flattering. Quote, it's somewhat flattering, especially when some of those comments are coming from some of the best players in the game, end quote. Now, I don't understand why Arrieta's bringing that up. As I said to Zach, he's answering a question that hasn't been asked. He is providing a solution to a problem that no one knows about. I have not heard, and I'm in this business. I make it a point to hear as much as I can. I watch sports television shows, whether they be, you know, anchored sports center shows with all of the highlights and the stories, or whether they be talk shows. And, of course, I listen to all of the radio shows that I can, including, you know, things like Mike and Mike in the Morning, which you hear right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket, Lebatard sometimes, Russillo and Canell sometimes, the TV guys First Take sometimes, on down the line. I make it my business to kind of look for these kind of – I have not heard – anybody in the game using the names the name Jake Arrieta and the letters PED together anywhere. And he says these comments are coming from some of the best players in the game. He said he would not name names during this interview. And he said his teammates are the ones who have told him that other players have wondered whether he's cheating. This year he's 4-0 with a 0.87 ERA, having a phenomenal season. He threw his second career no-hitter last Thursday against the Reds, second in his last 11 starts. In his last 24 starts, he is 20-1 with a 0.86 ERA. And he came over to the Cubs from the Orioles with a career ERA of over 5. Naturally, there are going to be some people who just maybe wonder it, but I don't know too many people irresponsible enough to say it out loud without any kind of suspicion or proof whatsoever. Any evidence, any hearsay, anything that's, you know, that would at least give justification for the conversation, if that makes sense. But people are going to wonder, at least in their own heads, how does a dude go from an ERA of 5 for his career to being one of the best pitchers in baseball? And he's right when he says here's his quote. He said, I think it's funny. I've always been in good shape. I just sucked early in my career from a statistical perspective, but my body has always been very similar to how it is now. The results are different, so people want to question things. That's the nature of sports, and I'm glad to hear him at least say that line, because it is the nature of sports, particularly in a sport like baseball, where some of the most prominent, celebrated, statistically superior players in the history of the game are on the outside looking in to Cooperstown because of the steroid scandal. And I don't have to go through all of the names of Bonds and Clemens and Sosa and McGuire and on down the line we go. I don't have to go through them all for you to know this. Yeah, people are going to kind of wonder. Barry Bonds once went from a career high of 49 home runs in a single season, barely missing that magical number that so few have hit, at least to that time, of 50 in a single season. He went from 49 not to 50. Not even to 55. Not even to 60. Not even to 65. He didn't even stop at 70. He went from 49, as you know, to 73. Crushing the record that had been crushed by another steroid cheat, Mark McGuire, who hit 70, which crushed Roger Maris's legitimate 61. And we all know McGuire had 70, Sosa had 66, Sosa had a couple more years in the 60s, and on down the line we go. And these are all the steroid cheats. But, yeah, we went when Bonds went from 49 to 73, people, what in the world? And they did look. Now, he was very different. We all know that his hat's highs grew about a size and a half. We all know, and anybody who's studied it or paid attention to it knows what his body did. His body went from a lean, svelte 185 to around 230 pounds of solid muscle. He looked like he was a bodybuilder. Arrieta hasn't changed. But as he says, this is just the nature of sports, particularly his sport. Arrieta's workout routine is reportedly crazy. His manager, Joe Maddon, said, quote, "I challenge anybody to go with him for his workout program for maybe a week. I won't even say a week. I'll say for 2 days. Just go keep up with him for 2 days and see what he's at, what he actually does and see if you could keep up with that particular workout program." So, great. He's a workout warrior, but does being a workout warrior suddenly make you have better command? Does it have make you have better velocity? Does it make you go from a 5 ERA career pitcher to a guy with 0.87? That's the question. My question to you, just to talk about it on the radio, and that's what we do is just kick this stuff around. It's so nice to be able to do that, especially because I involve myself in a lot of politics and wars and murders and rapes and crime rates and gun laws and everything else. And other times, it's so nice to be able to talk about things that just are fun. And this is fun. Baseball is fun. Do you think it's right? Do you think it's fair for anybody to question when somebody starts to become so much better than he ever was before and so much better than everybody else doing what he does, to question its legitimacy? Now, I'm going to hold my hand in the air here, not that you can see it, but I'm going to hold my hand in the air here and say this. About 8 years ago, 9 years ago, whatever year it was, and boy, I really got to look. I'm going to have to really look and see exactly what it was. When Joey Bats, Jose Bautista, really went crazy for the first time and did one of those years, you know, had one of those years when he hit 50-plus home runs, which was so much more than his previous career high. And let's see when that was. Jose Bautista was... This was 2010 when he was 29 years old. Now, you remember this? Jose Bautista, in 2010, playing for the Blue Jays, was 29. He had been in the bigs as a regular position player for 6 or 7 years before that. Okay? His first full year in the big leagues was with the Pirates in 2006 when he was 25 years old. That year, he had 16 home runs. Nice total. Nothing wrong with that. Okay? The next year with the Pirates in 07, he had 15. The year after that, 2008, he had 15. Year after that, 2008, he split time, because that's when he was traded. He split time with the Blue Jays and the Pirates. There they are. And yeah, it was 15. Okay. It was 12 with Pittsburgh and 3 with Toronto. I got a little caught off guard there with the way the stat sheet that I'm looking at worked or read. So he had 15. Then in 2009, full year with Toronto, first full year, he has 13 home runs. So I just gave you a 5-year span in which he had 16, 15, 15, and 13. Okay? That seems to be his ceiling. That's Jose Bautista. This is the kind of hitter he is. He's going to be a guy who hits you somewhere in the neighborhood of 240, 250 and gets you about 15 home runs and maybe 50, 60 RBIs a season. That's what he had been, right? And I'm looking at his batting average in all the years that I just gave you his home run totals. 235 in 2006. Then 254, 238, 242, 214. So he's around a 240, roughly 240, 245 average hitter with about 15 home run power and about 50 RBIs. That's who he is and was for a 5 or 6 year period of his career. Then suddenly, in 2010, at the age of 29, Jose Bautista goes from his average of 13, 14, 15 home runs a year and hits 54. And his average of around 50 RBIs a year jumps to 124. and his batting average, 260. And I'm going to tell you something. Why am I going back to Jose Bautista circa 2010? Because of the Jake Arrieta story and commentary here in 2016, where he said his sudden improvement has a lot of people kind of whispering about whether or not he's been using PEDs. And I will tell you this, that back in 2010, I was writing for a couple of newspapers, in a sports column for a couple of newspapers, one of them out west, and I won't say where, it doesn't matter, but in addition to my broadcasting, I was doing some sports writing, and I wrote a column and I went on the radio, and I was very, very, very openly questioning of Jose Bautista for that very reason. Dude, your previous career high was 16, you have hit 54. Your previous career high in RBIs was 63, you hit 124, you doubled it. There are going to be people asking questions. This is what I said in the column, and I said, you know, kind of theoretically to him without doing an interview with him. This is what I wrote, you know, dear Jose. People are going to wonder. People want to know how you got that good that quickly when you were, you know, 5 years into your major league career in your 20s, ages 25, 6, 7, 8. You were, you know, a 15 home run a year guy. Now suddenly at 29, you're a 54-year home run guy. I said, Jose, do us all a favor. Fill the cup. This is what I wrote. I said, Jose, do us a favor. Fill the cup. Meaning the urine cup. Volunteer to take a PED test if you're clean. Because otherwise, people are always going to have a suspicion. This is baseball, after all. This is 2010. Not too far removed from 2003 when Barry Bonds was doing his thing and Clemens and all the rest of them. Not too far removed. Fill the cup, Jose. And I took a lot of heat for it. A lot of writers, a lot of letter writers, a lot of commenters online and everything else said I was an idiot for even suggesting this. And you know what? They may have been right. But all I know is that's what I wondered, and I thought he should get out in front of it and prove it. And by the way, since that year that he hit 54 in 2010, all he's done is become one of the best power hitters in all of baseball, one of the most consistent power hitters in all of baseball. He had 43 and 103 in 2011, 27 and 65 in an injury short in 2012. Back to full-time 2013, he had, where's that total again? He had 28 and 73. Oh, that wasn't even full-time. He played 118 games. Back to a full-time 155 games in 2014, he had 35 home runs and 103. Then in last season, 40 and 114. This year he's off to a solid start with 4 home runs and 16 RBIs, batting 260. How did Jose Bautista go from a 15 and 50 guy to a routinely, you know, when he's playing a full season, 40-plus and 100-plus guy? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that I immediately suspected. Am I wrong for that? Maybe. Are people wrong for looking at Jake Arrieta and saying, Jake, how did you have a Jose Bautista epiphany? How did you have a turnaround that had you from a, you know, took you from a career? Let me bring up Jake's career stats real quick just for the purposes of this conversation. Jake Arrieta's career went like this in Baltimore. He started 18 games in 2010. He was 6-6 with an ERA of 4.66. The next year, he was 10-8 in 22 starts with a 5.05. The next year in 2012, he had 18 starts, 24 appearances. He was 3-9 with a 6.20. So obviously they moved into the pen for some of that year. 2013, he only pitched in 5 games. No, correction, because he was traded, so we got to combine these. And combined in 2013 with the Orioles and the Cubs, he was 5-4 with a 4.78. So then in 2014, here we go. Suddenly 10-5 with a 2.53. Last year, a Cy Young Award, 22-6 with a 1.77. This year, virtually untouchable with yet another no-hitter. How did you do it? Jake says people are whispering. And so he wanted to just address it out front, say, I take it as a compliment. He said it's flattering. But you know what? When he says it's flattering, what he means is he's ticked off. How dare somebody question my integrity? And I got to tell you, I understand if people who are why they are. And they don't even have to know you, Jake. I don't know you. But it makes me wonder, too. that make me a bad guy, just like it made me wonder about Jose Bautista in the middle of the last decade. Actually, at the end of the last decade, around 2010. Does it make me a bad guy? Does it make you a bad fan if you're wondering about these things, or is that just what sports has done to us? When somebody does something spectacular, we want to know why and how they got so much better. So interested in your thoughts on it. If you want to make the call at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. By the way, I'll give you one more before we go to this break. And before I tell you about some high school athletes deserving of some recognition, I'm going to give you this. Steph Curry. How did Steph Curry do it? Now, we know he's not cheating. We know he's not nothing to do with steroids. Absolutely impossible. Look at him. He's a wisp. He is just a little sliver of a man. And yet somehow he went from being, you know, a solid NBA 18-point-a-game type player to being the unstoppable 30-point-a-game scorer that he is today, two-time MVP, soon to be, and a three-point shooting records that you can't even imagine, the previous record being 268, his own, and then breaking that over the 400 mark? Are you kidding? People have been wondering that, too. How do guys just go from being solid players or average players, maybe even in some cases below average in Arrieta's case, to just being at the pinnacle of their profession without help? It's just the nature of the beast anymore. All right, let me do this. I know these guys don't have any help except their own hard work. As we say, congratulations and pay tribute to the KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week for today, Wednesday, April 27. For the girls, we want to say congrats to Kara and Landry Brown, two twins from Hilltop Track. They helped break two school records in a Hilltop win in a tri-match last week. Kara setting a new school record with a time of 27.2 in the 200. While Landry is part of the 4x8 relay team that won a school record time, one with a school record time of 10.45. So congratulations to Kara and Landry. For the boys, Cardinal Stritch baseball pitcher Grant Caravo, and I hope, Grant, I'm saying your name correctly. If it's Caravo, my apologies. But anyway, Grant, you know who you are. Struck out 11 in a five-inning no-hitter last week against Gibsonburg. The final was 11-0, stopped after five due to the mercy rule, but it still counts as a no-hitter. Stritch with a win improved to 6-6 on the year, pretty modest overall, but good enough for first place in the TAC with a 5-0 league record. So congratulations to the Brown twins and to the Cardinal Stritch baseball pitcher Grant Caravo. And again, I hope I got your name right. You are this week's KeyBank High School Athletes of the Week. And a reminder to you, if you have a suggestion for the KeyBank High School Athlete of the Week, somebody that you think deserves recognition and honors from us right here at Sports Radio, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, just send your nominations. Tell us what who they are and what their performances were in their chosen fields. Send that to athlete at 106.5theticket.com. And we will recognize them on an upcoming edition of the program. All right, going to take a quick time out here, get a bottom-of-the-hour sports center. Don't forget, in this last half hour, in addition to your phone calls on the subjects we just ran down, we're also going to have another giveaway for you. If you want a pair of tickets to go see John Mellencamp, he's going to be performing at Stranahan, and it's going to be on October 21st. We've been giving away tickets. Beat the box office tickets all week long right here on The Ticket. We'll do another one here in the next 20 minutes. That I can promise you. And then if you don't get them from us, tickets will be on sale on Friday at the box office, 866-240-1065. All right. No, that's our number. I beg your pardon. I don't have the actual number to buy the tickets, but they go on sale Friday, April 29th. I will give you a chance to win them at that number coming up within the next 20. Sports Center is next right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob Brandt's extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
438, the Bob France extravaganza on your radio on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Hey, can I just say something, by the way, real quick? I want to say thank you. Look, it's kind of a rule that you're not allowed to talk about ratings on the radio, and I certainly am not going to violate that rule by giving numbers. What I am going to say, though, just very generally, is this show, in the roughly year and a half that we've been on the radio together, is growing at an unbelievable rate. That's all I'll say, is I've got empirical evidence of that. The growth of this show, the number of new people coming on board and tuning in every afternoon just to talk sports with us, just to kind of have fun in what we like to call the toy box of life. After all of the bad stuff maybe you deal with all day long during your work day, And there's a lot of choices. I know there's a lot of great radio on in the afternoon, but a lot, so many people, I got to tell you, are finding their way right here to this program and to this radio station. And I just want to say thanks. That's all. I'm not going to belabor it, beat it to death, but I'm just going to say the growth is incredible. And I'm really, really, really happy and proud to be with you each and every afternoon. So I'll leave that there. All right, a couple of other things that I do want to get into before we're done. And I want to shift gears to the NFL because tomorrow, of course, is the NFL draft. We're going to carry the draft for you. Every round of the draft, round one, of course, tomorrow night, and then two rounds on Friday, and then the rest of it all day on Saturday. We're going to have that for you. And tomorrow during the extravaganza, we are going to look at it from the Lions and the Browns perspectives. Justin Rogers, longtime beat writer and a frequent guest of this program from Detroit, is going to tell us what Mr. Quinn is going to do or what he expects Mr. Quinn to try to do. The new GM, Bob Quinn, of the Lions, to talk about how they improve one of the NFL's most underachieving and disappointing teams from a year ago. The Browns are, quite frankly, the NFL's most disappointing and underachieving team. They're a train wreck. They have been since 1999 when they came back. I sat at Browns Stadium, then just called Cleveland Browns Stadium, for that opener when the Browns returned with their expansion franchise after Art Modell took the original Browns to Baltimore. I sat in that stadium. In fact, I still have a folder they gave out. They gave out a big bind, not a binder. What do you call it? It's kind of like a, I don't know. It's like a leather attaché, not an attaché, but like a leather, a binding type folder. Anyway, in 1999, you know, the Browns returned, and I watched them lose to the Pittsburgh Steelers 43-0 with Ty Detmer as their quarterback. And it was painful. And that was 1999. This is 2016, practically a lifetime later. And it's no better. How many draft picks have they had? How many opportunities? And you could say the same thing about the Lions. Through the Matt Millen years and the drafting of a new wide receiver, seems like every year within the top 5 or 10 picks, neglecting other huge holes on the team, falling for the likes of Mike Williams, falling for the likes of Charles Rogers. And I could say the same thing about the Lions, but the Browns have taken sucking at the draft to new heights, or depths, if you will. It has just been a comedy of errors that have brought them the likes of Cameron Irving in the first round, and Justin Gilbert in the first round, and Johnny Manziel in the first round, and Brandon Weeden in the first round, and Trent Richardson in the first round. I mean, it's just a comedy how bad they have been at drafting. And tomorrow, well, they secured a whole bunch more picks, but they moved from 2 to 8, so they have two of the top two first-round picks in the top 32, obviously. They have 8 and 32. Are they going to butcher this one, too? An entirely new approach, by the way, if you're keeping score at home. New GM. Actually, technically, he's not the GM. Sasha Brown is just in charge of all football operations, even though he's never been in charge of football operations anywhere in his life. His top chosen man, or at least Jimmy Haslam, the owner's top chosen man, to help advise him on how to run this draft and how to select his 53-man roster, is a number-crunching stat nerd. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, but, you know, I think even stat nerds kind of like take that word as a badge of honor now. You know, if you're a stat nerd, you're like, you know, you're like Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, for crying out loud. You know, a nerd who sits in his dorm room writing code all day long and creates something that makes him a multi-billionaire. So I don't mean it as an insult when I say, but a stat nerd, a stat geek, or whatever. Paul D. Podesta, who's been crunching numbers and doing analytics for baseball for the last 10 years for the Mets. Well, not all for the Mets, but most recently, and the A's before that. Anyway, he's crunching numbers for the Browns. I have no faith whatsoever in the new drafting regime or the drafting organization or front office than I did with the last ones. But we're going to talk about the Browns side with Scott Petrak tomorrow, in addition to the Lions side with Justin Rogers. Now, off the board, Justin Rogers from MLive.com, in case you're wondering, off the board from those two, one of the biggest stories of the draft tomorrow is taking shape this week in Philadelphia. If you recall, if you listened to last week's show, I had on a writer from the SB Nation Eagles site, bleedinggreen.com, I believe is what it was, bleedinggreen.com. And we were talking about the trade that the Browns made with the Eagles for the Eagles to go from 8 to 2 and the Browns to drop to number 8 and pick up a whole bunch of picks. And let me remind myself of the specifics of that deal. The Eagles got the Browns number 2 and the Browns' fourth round pick in 2017. The Browns get number 8. They get number 77, the Eagles' third round pick this year. Number 100, the Eagles' fourth round pick this year. The Eagles' first round pick next year and their second round pick in 2018. So a big haul of picks. Anyway, that trade, while being, you know, of course, a blockbuster and having a lot of people in Ohio wondering about the Browns' wisdom of giving up an opportunity to get the franchise quarterback they have lacked for so long, and the Eagles giving up so many picks to take a guy who is a no sure thing, believed probably to be Carson Wentz from North Dakota State. So that's all the backdrop you probably already knew, but I bring it up because of what it did to Sam Bradford. Sam Bradford, the incumbent starter in Philadelphia, just signed a month ago, roughly a month ago, a 2-year, $35 million extension that kept him off of the free agent market and kept him in Philadelphia as the starting quarterback there. Bradford was the number 1 overall pick in 2010, if you recall, from the Rams, but he has endured, to say an underwhelming career, not endured, he's put together an underwhelming career is an understatement. 6 seasons, the first 5 in St. Louis, hasn't had a winning season yet. He's been injured, out of the lineup, and quite frankly, like I said, underachieving, underperforming. Well, when he found out that the Eagles traded with the Browns to get the second pick so that they can take a quarterback, Sam Bradford lost it, immediately demanded a trade. Why does he want a trade? Well, because apparently he's not real keen on the idea of competing for his job with the hotshot rookie number two in the draft. His agent, Tom Condon, had to answer questions about this. He did a 4-minute interview on a Sirius XM station talking NFL, and he was asked, why does Sam Bradford, your client, want out of Philadelphia right a month after signing that 2-year, $35 million extension? Condon was forced into the unenviable position of defending Bradford's call for a trade. Marcus Hayes of Philly.com, who writes for the Inquirer and the Daily News in Philadelphia, covered this entire press conference and wrote an exceptional article. I should link it up to our Twitter feed at Sports Radio 106.5 about Tom Condon. He was asked to defend something that is straight up indefensible. And in the defense, Condon painted Bradford, and this is by way of Marcus Hayes and the Daily News columnist, like I said, for Philly.com, painted Bradford as a mediocre quarterback who is terrified of competition, is unsure that he will ever play well again, and that if he doesn't, is scared that the fans will call for the backup to take his job. That was his defense of Sam Bradford. He stammered, he grasped, he gasped, he failed in the defense of Sam Bradford because he knows that what Bradford doing is indefensible. In the past calendar year, according to the Eagles, Bradford has declined several long-term offers from them to be the long-term guy. But now suddenly, with the specter of a talented kid being drafted number 2 and being groomed as the heir apparent, Bradford is trying to force the Eagles to trade him. This despite the fact that he had to know the Eagles were going to draft a quarterback at some point this weekend in the draft, if not number 2, you know, in a later pick, maybe with number 77, which the Browns now have. There was going to be competition there. There was going to be a new number 2 quarterback there behind Bradford one way or the other. But what Condon was forced to do in defending Bradford is to acknowledge that Bradford is a wuss, because what he wants is a guaranteed starting spot for as long as he wants it, even beyond the 2-year extension that he signed, no matter how well or how poorly he plays. Condon said in this interview that Bradford is very competitive. Said he's very competitive, except for the fact that a kid, Carson Wentz, likely to be the number 2 pick, who has a grand total of 23 starts in a second-tier football program, by the way, at North Dakota State, is likely to be the guy behind him that is forcing him to ask for a trade. That doesn't sound like somebody very competitive. You can't beat out this North Dakota State kid for as long as you want. Or unless the competition is a career backup with 2 NFL starts, because the other guy that Bradford complained about being in Philadelphia is Chase Daniel, who came over with new head coach Doug Peterson from Kansas City. Condon said, Chase Daniels here, and they paid him a substantial amount of money to be on this roster as well. In other words, Bradford doesn't like that. They got a well-paid backup, which means they could quickly pull him. This is an amazing example of what you never want to have. And I bring this up primarily because, well, I think it's hilarious because of the way it makes Condon look, most importantly because of the way it makes Bradford look. He signed a two-year deal and now is complaining that they're not going to commit to him long-term. They tried to get him long-term, and he's afraid they won't commit to him because they're going to draft a quarterback number two overall. He had an opportunity to lock himself up long-term, but he chose not to. I bring this up because of the state of the NFL going into tomorrow night's draft. It is so hard to find a quarterback that is worth his weight in salt, for crying out loud, let alone gold. It is so hard to find quality, capable quarterbacks. Look where the Denver Broncos just turned. When Peyton Manning retired after the Super Bowl and Brock Osweiler left as a free agent with the Texans, look at the Texans. They just went from Brian Hoyer, journeyman, to Brock Osweiler and gave him superstar franchise QB money for seven starts in his NFL career. That's all he's got. The Texans are an example of how hard it is. The Broncos turned to Mark Sanchez to replace Osweiler. That's how hard it is. I say that to you because if you're a Lions fan, don't ever complain about Matthew Stafford. If he has a bad game, if he has a bad year, if he can't win a playoff game, count yourself fortunate that you have somebody that you can rely upon to be a quality, if not a superstar, but a quality, capable quarterback who can win games, even 11 of them in one season the way he did 2 years ago, career high. Because it's just that hard. The Browns still don't have one and haven't had one since 1999 when they came back. Technically, since probably Bernie Kosar back in 1993. Because after they let him go with Bill Belichick's famous diminishing skills line, it was Vinny Testaverde and Todd Philcox and a bunch of other nobodies till they left. And then, of course, it started all over with Detmer in 99. The Browns still don't have a quarterback, even though Robert Griffin is sitting on the roster. Count yourself lucky if you're a Lions fan. This is what you could be facing. A leader like Sam Bradford, coward that he is. It's that difficult to find starting quarterbacks. All right, going to take a timeout, but before I do, I want to hook you up real quick with what I promised you that I've been doing each and every day this week, and will continue for the rest of this week, and that is an opportunity to beat the box office. If you are interested in, if you're interested in going to see John Mellencamp at the Stranahan Theater on October 21st, tickets are on sale this Friday, April 29th, but I'll help you beat the box office right now. Caller 10 at 866-240-1065, 866-240-1065. We'll give you a pair of those right now. Caller 10 at 866-240-1065, Mellencamp, Stranahan, October 21st. Good luck to you. We'll be back right after this.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.